gentrification mean to you? Today, we'll examine the changing urban landscape of San Francisco and Northern California as housing prices continue to rise. As cities evolve, is gentrification inevitable? Can it be managed? Does living in a city with mixed-income residents make it a better place? Can a city grow without pushing out its poorer residents? And if even the middle class is squeezed, where does that leave those most in need? It's your call with me, Holly Kernan, and you after this news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. Syrian pro-government forces have recaptured the strategic town of Qusair after a siege lasting more than 2 weeks. The rebels said they withdrew overnight. We'll hear from our Middle East correspondent shortly, but first, this report from Lise Doucette in Qusair describing the devastation.
We've been to Qusair, or what's left of Qusair, a bustling city where 30,000 once lived, is now a city in ruins. We didn't see a single building that escaped 3 weeks of intense fighting. We only saw a handful of civilians, a few farmers on tractors heading out of the city, one family loading a pickup. But the troops were everywhere, traveling in trucks and armored vehicles, firing guns in celebration, moving on foot.
Damascus described the success in Qusair as an important strategic victory. Our Middle East correspondent Jim Muir has been assessing the developments from across the border in Lebanon.
After a battle lasting 2.5 weeks, Syrian government troops are now combing and securing Al-Qusair and calling on its inhabitants to return. One reason given by the rebels for their decision to pull out during the night was that they've been starved of weapons, despite the European decision to lift the embargo on supplies to them. All this augurs ill for the proposed international peace conference the Russians and Americans have been discussing with the UN in Geneva. They've been unable to set a date, but we'll talk about talks again towards the end of the month.
The new Pakistani Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, has been sworn into office for an unprecedented third term. He was sworn in by President Zardari in Islamabad. Earlier, Mr. Sharif made a speech to Parliament in which he called for an end to US drone strikes. The BBC correspondent in Islamabad says Mr. Sharif will have to grapple with a range of problems, including militant violence, endemic corruption, and lengthy power cuts. Nawaz Sharif, who was overthrown by the military almost 14 years ago, was re-elected last month with a comfortable majority. The Malian army says its soldiers have clashed with Tuareg separatists near the northern town of Kidal. It's the first time the Malian army has fought against the Tuareg separatists since a French-led military intervention in the north in January made it possible for Mali's military to return there. Tom Mafesi reports from Dakar.
A spokesman for the Tuareg rebels has confirmed that the unexpected attack by government troops had forced the MNLA fighters to pull out of Anifis and regroup in the surrounding mountains. The Malian army has sent hundreds of troops with the aim of retaking the northern town of Kidal, a historic stronghold for Tuareg rebellions. The push by the Malian army comes as talks had resumed between the rebel group and the transitional authorities in neighbouring Burkina Faso. The French had so far kept government troops away from Kidal, fearing ethnic clashes.
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. An American soldier, accused of killing 16 Afghan civilians last year, has pleaded guilty in a deal to avoid the death penalty. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales entered his plea in a courtroom at a military base near the city of Seattle. Prosecutors say Sergeant Bales left his remote base in southern Afghanistan in the early hours of the morning and opened fire on unarmed civilians, mostly women and children, in two nearby villages. The former head of security at Ghana's international airport has been charged in the United States with trying to smuggle Afghan heroin into America. Solomon Adelakwaye was arrested with two Nigerians and a Colombian last month following a joint U.S.-Ghanaian investigation. The prosecution alleges that U.S. agents disguised themselves as drug dealers and held meetings with the accused over the past year to buy thousands of dollars worth of Afghan heroin to be distributed in New York. A Somali Islamic centre in North London has been destroyed by a fire in an apparently racially motivated attack. The letters EDL, thought to represent the far-right English Defence League, were sprayed on the building. London's mayor, Boris Johnson, called the attack cowardly and pathetic. Counter-terrorism police are investigating the cause of the fire. Mohammed Ali from the local Somali community says there's a sense of defiance over the attack.
As a community, we are very shocked, but I think this will make us more stronger as a whole. And you know what? We are a peaceful, loving community within Barnet, and we have lived in Barnet for the past 20 years, and we haven't seen such a thing.
Chinese researchers have found what's thought to be the oldest primate fossil ever discovered. The beautifully preserved skeleton, the size of a mouse, was found in Hubei province and is 55 million years old. The researchers believe this was among the first primates to emerge after the extinction of the dinosaurs. It could be an ancestor of monkeys and humans. BBC News.
Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. The battle over gentrification in the Bay Area has been raging for over half a century. Many San Francisco residents are adamant about retaining the quirkiness that some say makes the city special. Some are concerned that the influx of wealthy tech companies is driving out poorer residents and even those in the middle class. San Francisco is ranked as the fourth most expensive city in the U.S. Median monthly rents are over $2,000. Concern over rising costs cuts across political party, class, and race. So what does it mean to be a local, and does that title confer some special status on you? City dwellers and many development and advocacy organizations are attempting to balance the interests of quality of life and equality of access. Is it possible to improve the livability of a city, building parklets, parks, bike lanes, improving safety, while also preventing housing costs from skyrocketing? Should we provide housing for everyone who wants to live here? How can we build a city that remains inclusive for both low-income families and the booming technology industry? Well, that will be our discussion today. And joining us to talk about that in studio, Carl Beitel is a writer and scholar who currently lives in San Francisco. He's co-director of the Urban Institute for Development and Economic Alternatives. His new book, Local Protest, Global Movements, Capital Community and the State in San Francisco, examines the history of gentrification and local opposition in San Francisco. And he'll be reading and discussing the book tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Green Arcade in San Francisco. We're also joined on the phone by Michael Yarny, who's a partner at Build Inc., which is a San Francisco-based urban mixed-use residential developer. He's also executive director of UP, which is a civic entrepreneurship incubator that seeks to provide alternatives to traditional redevelopment activities. And welcome to both of you, Carl and Michael.
Thank you, Holly, for having me on.
And Michael, yeah. Do we hear you? Yeah?
Yeah, thanks for hosting.
Okay, so let's start. I want to ask both of you to tell me what the word gentrification means to you. Why don't we start with Carl?
Well, I would describe gentrification as a process in which housing prices rise. It's an expression of income inequality. So certain sectors that are earning much higher incomes begin to demand housing in areas that have traditionally been inhabited by working class, often people of color. Prices begin to rise. Affordability begins to decline. You then begin to see a lot of very problematic consequences, such as a rise in evictions, displacement, people having to move or losing places that they live for a long time. And I would say it's also tied to certain demographic shifts. So you often get an increase in single households, a loss of families from certain cities, the areas in which gentrification is taking place. And it's also linked to financial mechanisms. So a lot of times gentrification is linked to a speculative dynamic where developers and financiers begin to see opportunities to create profits by developing new housing or evicting existing residents. And so you get a lot of these financial mechanisms, and there's a speculative dynamic.
And Michael, how about you? What does the word gentrification mean to you when we talk about that term?
Yeah, well, it's a very complex term and a very loaded term, and I think it conflates many things. And so I think it's a valuable term, but it's often used in many different ways. To me, what I often hear when people use it, they are often conflating two distinct things that sometimes accompany one another, which is displacement, on the one hand, and usually the people are speaking about tenants, residential displacement, but also sometimes commercial displacement, you know, shops and businesses that once characterized an area leaving. And on the other hand, reinvestment in a given neighborhood. And I think sometimes those are distinct things, but sometimes they accompany one another. I would argue that they're not necessarily synonymous, that you can have reinvestment without necessarily displacement, but that I think the term often implies involuntary displacement. That is, folks who would like to stay can't stay because of rising costs, let's just say, in general, in the housing stock and even in commercial rents. And so I think, and often it's also a proxy for a cultural debate around who is authentic, who belongs, who has a right to be in the neighborhood. So I think it's often used in a very cultural way. And then finally, and this is building off of our comment that my colleague on the show just shared, I think sometimes there's confusion around what the causes of gentrification. And I view gentrification more as a descriptive term. There's both people, and from my perspective, would argue that gentrification in the Bay Area specifically is mainly demand driven. There's a lot of people who want to live here and a lot of jobs. There's often in some different markets, not San Francisco. There's others who advocate what they call a supply-side view of gentrification, where improvements being made to a neighborhood somehow draw people to that neighborhood, and that's the cause for rising rents or rising commercial rents.
Like a redevelopment project, for example. Carl is wanting to get in here. Go ahead, Carl.
I just want to kind of build on that also. I think that there are two sides to gentrification. There's what we might call the supply side, which is the creation of economic conditions that make it feasible and very profitable to redevelop areas, to reinvest in areas, and then what I mentioned is some of the more problematic consequences, evictions and displacements, and there's demand-side shifts. So when we look at gentrification, if we look at it in a larger context, a larger historical context, what we really are seeing is the playing out of this reversal, where there was this long period that it really begins in the 1930s, and then it accelerates in the period after 1945, where you have white flight, you have massive suburbanization, you have this huge housing development occurring outside the central cities. And the central cities, they're subject to things like redlining, denial of mortgage access, high unemployment. So you create certain conditions where property values begin to fall. And what that does is it means that when demand shifts, or when perceptions about where it's desirable to live shift, which again is a very complex phenomenon, there's cultural factors, there's changes in people's perceptions, lifestyle changes, changes in household composition, demographic changes. There's a lot of different things that enter into that. But it's the combination of both these things, of both a cycle of disinvestment that creates low disinvested areas within central city regions, and then this shift that brings higher income populations back.
So let's get into a little bit of the history that you go into in your book, Carl. You use San Francisco as kind of a test case, looking at social movements and what they have been able to accomplish in terms of shaping the development of a city. And you go into the fight over housing rights, tenants' rights, rent control, the Central Freeway construction. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us about a couple of these examples, and let's start with the Central Freeway. What happened there?
Well, what happened is that there was this plan that goes back to the 1950s, and the state wanted to build freeways that were going to ring San Francisco. So there was a plan to build a freeway all along the northern edge of the city, and that there were then going to be freeway extensions down through Golden Gate Park into the southern part of the city. And then there was also, at one point, a plan to build an additional bridge over the East Bay. And what happened is that there was a coalition that emerged. Now, another thing that was beginning to happen around this period of time is you started to have high-rise buildings being created in residential neighborhoods. Again, a lot of this was in the northern part of the city. So there's a There's still some of these buildings on Russian Hill. You can actually go see them. There's a big building down by Fisherman's Wharf that cut off the views. So there was this growing concern about what gentrification was doing to the quality, the urban amenities, the things people loved about San Francisco. And then on top of that, there was this plan to build this huge freeway system, and people saw that as a real threat to the existing quality of urban life. So there was a coalition that was based in neighborhood movements, early environmental groups, that came together, and eventually, through lobbying the Board of Supervisors, I think the actual final blockage happened in 1965, and they were able to actually halt freeway construction. It was very interesting. If you moved to San Francisco in the early 80s, you could still see downtown. There was this actual freeway extension.
And it
stopped. And literally, they were constructing this freeway, and they got the halt order, and that was actually the evidence of stoppage. So that was a very important struggle. And interestingly, there was another very crucial struggle that happened around that time that was in the Fillmore District, which at that point was primarily a black neighborhood. And there was a federal program that had been instituted in 1954. It was called Urban Renewal. And what it basically did is it provided federal money to local governments if local governments declared an area in need of redevelopment, that it had, you know, poverty.
So-called blight.
Blight, what was called blight at the time. And you could declare an area blighted, and then you could zone it for redevelopment. And basically what it initially meant is that you condemned large sectors of housing, you evicted residents. They got certain relocation guarantees, but those often didn't work. There was a huge problems with actually getting residents back into neighborhoods. You brought in bulldozers, and you raised just entire sections of the
city. Demolished, yeah.
Yeah, so the equivalent to what they did in the Fillmore District is they basically bulldozed from Fillmore Street from Gary down to about, it was past Turk Street. It would be the equivalent if you went into the Mission today in terms of the effect of the neighborhood, and you basically bulldozed from 24th Street down to 16th Street. It took the core of the neighborhood, and it just razed it. Massive displacement, destroyed a lot of the cultural institutions. There were just these tremendous problems it created. But what was interesting about that is there was a very active base of neighborhood opposition that emerged, and it began to give rise to this challenge and this idea that ordinary residents, ordinary constituents could begin to challenge these large forces that were driving displacement and redevelopment. So what's interesting about San Francisco is you have these two early battles, the freeway battle and then the battle around A2 and development. And the
kind of the pushback against urban renewal.
The pushback against it. And what was happening in San Francisco is it was also very interesting because the mayor who came into office in 1967, Joseph Alioto, he was a very brilliant politician. And he understood that he could use redevelopment to create a pro-growth coalition. And what that coalition did is it linked business, downtown business that were interested in redevelopment, to labor. And the idea was that you build this coalition between business and labor. You use the redevelopment agency to give perks, to give jobs, to essentially co-opt potential opposition from labor. You create this coalition and you push for development. And that was opposed by these neighborhood groups, these community-based organizations that were emerging in the Fillmore District. What is interesting about it is that it gave rise to a kind of a tension that has characterized politics in San Francisco in some way ever since, where you have on the one side business often aligned with labor pushing development. The idea is that we're creating jobs, we're creating growth, this is good, we're going to boost revenues. And then on the other side, you have tenant groups, community-based organizations, housing associations who are opposing this based on what are the effects? Who's being displaced? Is this going to be affordable? What about infrastructure? All the costs, right? So this is one of the things I look at in the book at some length, is trying to understand this tension and how it's played out and how
that shaped the city.
And how it's really shaped the city. I mean, it's kind of been the fundamental theme of development politics and really politics in San Francisco for the last 30 years. And we're seeing it again today. I mean, this current debate we're having around what's happening with this new high-rise market rate development, the tech boom, again, it's a kind of alignment where on the one hand, people are saying we're creating jobs, this is creating opportunity, these are good jobs. And on the other hand, people, you know, the people opposing this are concerned about it, are saying, but who's being displaced? How are you going to deal with affordability issues? What about the infrastructure costs? All the things that go with development that are often not factored in when developers apply for permits and build high-rise or market-rate housing. So there are all these costs that need to be factored in.
And Michael, from your perspective as a developer, what kind of dialogue is happening between developers, residents, activists? I mean, do you feel like that dialogue is productive and is happening right now? How are you viewing all of this?
Well, this is such a rich topic. There's a lot to say. Well, first of all, this city is known for extraordinary amounts of dialogue, and in fact, I would even make the provocative statement: we have too much process and not enough quality product. And in fact, in San Francisco, in a recent academic study in terms of cities with restrictive and local regs on land use, ranked as the second most stringent regulatory environment among the 2,600 cities that were surveyed. We are, this is from the Wharton Residential Land Use Regulatory Index. We are an incredibly restrictive and complicated city to do business in, and specifically to do development in. And this city is sort of, people come from New York here and they're flabbergasted. They can't believe the amount of process and input. Now that's not to suggest at all that there isn't an important role for quality participation. And in fact, a lot of that happens. The city's just gone through an exhaustive 10-plus year process with the Eastern Neighborhoods Plan. Huge, I think almost a fifth of the city was rezoned, and there were 10 years of workshops and community input, and we now have a significantly improved plans for four vital neighborhoods. A similar process went on with Market Octavia, a process just completed for the Western Soma that was almost 10 years in length, and now a process is underway for what's called the Central Corridor, which is a key transit-oriented area around 4th Street, where the new Central Subway will be servicing. So this city actually has a long history in the last 20 years, I want to emphasize, of much more participation and involvement, and some would argue excessive. Why excessive? Because unfortunately the system we've created tends to elevate certain voices and not others. And
well, let me ask you about that, Michael. I want to ask both you and Carl about that. I think in Carl's book he's really arguing that these kind of neighborhood struggles really led to more direct democracy in the city, and you seem to be saying that that's not necessarily a good thing. So maybe you two can both talk about that. Let me start with Carl and then go back to you, Michael.
Okay, what I would like to return, though, because Carl brought up some really interesting historical things.
I promise we'll get back to it.
Okay.
So so this whole idea of, in your book, Carl, you're talking about this has led to a lot of direct democracy, right? Mm. People having much more power in city government and really shaping policy, understanding land use policies and advocating for neighborhood and residential rights, and so that it's less of a kind of top-down approach to development. What I'm hearing Michael say is that that's not necessarily a good thing, that there's so much process in this city that you're not able to have progress. I hope I'm conveying that correctly, Michael.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
This is a complicated issue. There is certainly NIMBYism, or a lot of processes that take place around trying to block certain developments or regulate certain developments that may not be based on a larger understanding of what's in some kind of general interest. I don't think anyone would deny that. NIMBYism has been a problem both, it's often a problem for people trying to develop affordable housing. Right. I mean, NIMBYism can be
not in my backyard. Right.
Right. Not in my backyard. We don't want affordable housing here. So there's clearly blocking tactics. There's legal obstruction that sometimes I think creates the problems Michael is talking about. What I argue in the book, I think, is a little bit different than that. There's sort of two aspects to it. One is that there have been a lot of struggles to halt or slow down or reshape development. And a lot of that is not based on just trying to regulate or just trying to block, but it's trying to actually mitigate some of the costs. So when you put in dense infill development, there are going to be all kinds of infrastructure costs. There are going to be all kinds of things that if you don't have activism around that and you don't have people acting as watchdogs and trying to regulate some of these things, developers will not do this on their own. The market will not deal with what economists often call externalities. So that there's been a lot of effort to regulate these types of things. And I think that in terms of the local political process, yes, I would argue that there have been major gains in terms of making local planning, making the local political process more accountable to ordinary residents, and that if you don't defend those things, if you don't have those channels where people can raise concerns, pressure local government officials, pressure the planning department, these types of things, you'll get a form of development that would in some ways replicate what we used to see, where you just have massive displacement and very little attempt to integrate the concerns of different sectors.
And Michael, let me go back to you and then we'll get to the history and go back over that. But I don't know if you wanted to respond to Carl on this question of democracy.
Yeah, no, Carl, I really appreciate you acknowledging the ever-present problem of NIMBYism. And Carl's absolutely right. I mean, when you create a very process-heavy system, and trust me, we have about the most process-heavy system, and certainly in the state and arguably in the country, you create an opportunity for what I jokingly sometimes call the tyranny of the minority. In particular, in San Francisco, because of the way that the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, as it's called, is used, a few individuals who do not even come close to representing the overall general interest can block a project and kill it. The most egregious example of this kind of delay was where a group of individuals on the west side of the city who opposed the San Francisco's bike plan effectively held it up in court for 4 years. There was an injunction against the city where literally the city was forbidden from installing bike racks for years using the California Environmental Quality Act. This is a bike plan that was approved by an 11-0 majority of the Board of Supervisors that had widespread public support. And because of the way that San Francisco has implemented CEQA, partly in response to cries from certain neighborhood organizations that their voices aren't heard enough, we've created a legal morass where a few individuals can block very good things from happening in a reasonable time frame. Now, I want to distinguish this. This is a very different thing than saying there shouldn't be good, solid participation in the democratic process of electing the Board of Supervisors, of course, and then in making decisions on urban planning. But what's happened is that we've created a lawyer's fantasy here, where if you can afford to hire, if you can bring on a public interest attorney or afford to hire a private attorney, an individual can wreak havoc on implementing community plans that have broad consensus. And Carl is right to point out that one of the biggest victims of this is the affordable housing community. It is extremely difficult to do affordable housing projects on the north side of the city or on the west side of the city, precisely in areas that don't have much affordable housing, because those residents know how to use those participatory tools. And so my argument is simply not that we don't have participation, but that we need to think very carefully about the where and when it happens, and when our elected officials make a majority decision to move forward with a particular approach after due consideration, we should be able to implement that.
So Carl wants to get in on that question, but we're going to have to go to a break. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're speaking with San Francisco writer and researcher Carl Beitel, whose book Local Protest, Global Movement examines the history of local opposition to so-called gentrification in the city. We're also joined by Michael Yarny, who's a partner at Build Inc., which is a local developer. And we're talking about development and looking at what's happened in San Francisco as kind of a test case, and asking how do we balance the interests of all residents as a city expands and develops, and particularly in a time like this when you're having rising housing costs. And we'll want to invite you to join our conversation. Our number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. I'll give it out again right after the break. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We will be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation today, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation with John Trudell, who's an acclaimed poet and activist. His involvement in the 21-month-long occupation of Alcatraz Island in the late 1960s brought international attention to the American Indian cause. We'll ask, what are the keys to a successful protest movement? Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable. We'll talk with journalists about the week's news. And today we're speaking with San Francisco writer and researcher Carl Beitel, whose book Local Protest, Global Movement examines the history of local opposition to so-called gentrification in San Francisco. We're also joined by Michael Yarny, who's a partner at Build Inc., which is a mixed-use residential developer. And we're asking the question, how do we balance the interests of all residents as the city expands and develops? And as I let me invite our listeners, and then we'll get back to those two questions that we left on the table. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. And if you remember land use debates and struggles, we'd love to hear from you about your experience. And if you live in a rapidly changing area of San Francisco or the Bay Area or the South Bay, what have you observed? How do you define gentrification? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. What would you like development to look like in your city or neighborhood? And have you ever been active about advocating for it? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number, and we'd love to hear from you. Okay, so I want to get to the history with Michael in just a moment, but Carl, you wanted to respond to something that Michael was saying right before we went to the break.
Yeah, just briefly. I think that the danger when, I'm not saying Michael is advocating for this, but the danger, the red flag that goes up when people start talking about overregulation of the market and trying to roll back some of the obstructionist tactics that take place is that unless you have a plan for affordability, a plan for revenue, a plan to deal with long-term costs, a plan to mitigation plans, right, of all the things that we've been talking about, what that really becomes, or what it can become, is a backdoor way for market rate developers to try and streamline and ram through projects. And so I think we need to be very, very careful when we start to put the emphasis on the problem is overly regulated markets. Developers have always, in San Francisco, found their way around almost any existing regulation when it became profitable to build. They're doing it now. They did it during the dot-com boom with LiveWork. Developers make enormous amounts of money. The expected rate of return, there are studies out, the expected rate of return private market rate developers expect to get on housing in San Francisco is astronomical. I have a study, right, I could actually quote some numbers. And I think that that's where we need to start with, is that there are very powerful forces, global investors at this point, money from all over the world that is looking to San Francisco to generate very high rates of return. And so, again, we need to be very, very careful. And I think that the issue is really about affordability. It's about how we create housing for a broad range of people in San Francisco. It's about defending people against the pressures of eviction that are going on. And I think that those things, in a vision, really, of what kind of city do we want to live in, whose interest should development serve, who is being served by current development, that's really what we need to think about. I think that's far more important than this debate about an overly regulated market.
So, yeah, great. Michael. Yeah, I appreciate it, Carl. I really appreciate your perspective. And I just wanted to say that the danger, and it's very tempting. And I, you know, we have a rhetorical tradition in San Francisco, which I appreciate. I came here partly because I love our anti-establishment, bohemian, and generally left-leaning perspective. But the danger is that we end up in an echo chamber where everyone likes to blame these so-called outside forces. And often when I hear the rhetoric, and I'm not saying Carl's engaging in this, but I've been in so many community meetings, there's this notion of those guys, those others, the New York investors, the global capitalists. And it's very tempting to create this big brother who's pulling the strings. And I can tell you, as someone who has been both very active in nonprofits and very active in for-profits, and I've worked for two mayors, that it's not as tempting as it is to paint a picture of some big downtown boogeyman. That is not the way it happens in San Francisco. We are a city of neighborhoods, and we are one of the most decentralized in terms of power cities I've ever experienced. Partly because of those fights that Carl was alluding to, the freeway wars and the battles in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which did a lot of good things for the city, by the way. But it would be a mistake, and in fact, I think it would be a tragedy if, and I heard in Carl's comments some suggestion that those market rate developers, the market rate developers are an absolute necessary part of the solution. And it's this black and white language that concerns me in San Francisco dialogue. Carl alluded earlier to the fights against the freeways and the horrible blight removal of the 50s and 60s. And, you know, I think universally everyone now acknowledges those were urban planning disasters. But to conflate those actions, which, by the way, were government actions. I mean, the paradox is these were huge government programs, arguably bypassing the, quote, market, and relying on huge government action and subsidy to do wholesale remaking of neighborhoods in ways that no one would contemplate today. We're in a much more complex environment today. We don't have those big government actors. In fact, redevelopment has been abolished.
And dissolved by Governor Jerry Brown, yeah.
Yeah, gone. It's gone. I mean, so we actually, it's very interesting. We actually have an era of, we don't have that big brother actor anymore. But what the point I want to get to, the worst thing of all would be to continually read all history, including our current times, through the lens of those 1950s, 1960s battles. And I see that so often. And Carl, I have no idea how old you are. I've never met you. But with older demographics in the city, it's almost like a trauma. People repeating those phrases. And in fact, we're in a very different environment today. And my great concern is that we're putting out fire with gasoline when we say stop the market rate developers. And why? Because San Francisco's housing affordability crisis is directly related to the fact that the city has chronically undersupplied market rate housing for decades. Seattle, on the other hand, which has experienced much stronger job growth than San Francisco, has also consistently produced a lot more housing. And as a result, their rent increases have been dramatically lower. By one study, as much as 33% lower over a period of years. And so my response is to say this has to be a yes-and solution. Yes to affordable housing that's subsidized for that very low-income and low-income segment that the market can't serve. But yes also to that very important market-rate housing. If we don't build it, the gentrification and the displacement will only accelerate.
And you're listening to Your Call. That's Michael Yarny. He's a partner with Build Inc., which is a San Francisco-based urban mixed-use residential developer. We've also got Carl Beitel, who is the author of Local Protest, Global Movements, Capital Community, and State in San Francisco. And we're looking at development in this city and in Northern California and looking at the lessons we can learn from historical social movements and the fact that right now we have a really big boom here and rising housing prices. And so how do we do sustainable, rational development? And I really want to get to some of our callers. We've got a lot of people on the line, but go ahead, Carl, you wanted to respond.
Just quickly, just to clarify, the vast majority of my book is actually not about the freeway battle and A2. The vast majority of the studies and the history I recount is in the last 20 years. So I'm actually looking at a shift, exactly what Michael talked about, away from a kind of state-led mode of redevelopment to a market-led mode of redevelopment. And I just wanted to say very briefly, I'm not trying to demonize market-rate developers, but what I would say, and there may be differences on this, is that market-led development cannot in and of itself address the problems of affordability in a market like San Francisco. And I think that there's also been this long... that what Michael is saying of this claim that there's limited supply, there have been other studies done. I've actually published a study that looked at the effects of zoning controls, land use controls on housing supply in San Francisco and found no effect. So I think that developers have, again, found their way around existing regulations. And the problem is that you have limited space, you have limited land, and just flooding a limited area like that with market rate housing or just opening up to development is not in and of itself going to address affordability problems. I think most people would probably agree with that.
And it sounds like Michael is agreeing with that as well. I have so many callers on the line. I really want to get to them. So Alex in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Thank you. I want to say housing projects are the worst thing ever thought of, both for the people who live in them and for the neighborhoods that where they are located.
Alex, what do you mean when you refer to housing projects?
Projects, what comes to mind when I say that? The neighborhoods where nobody dares to go by.
Are you referring to public housing?
Public housing, where we have bantustans, like in South Africa, with certain neighborhoods that are only for certain types of people, and the criminal crime factories, where poor people live there in concentration camp-like life, where police dare not go in there to bust a criminal who runs into the housing jungle. And kids born, raised to adulthood, and die in the same housing project, never knowing the larger society, even within the city, let alone the world. What we need is people's integration, not segregation. You started school busing to integrate students. The same thing. People should be integrated as to where they live so they can learn from each other, and that nobody can overpower anybody by sheer numbers of this type of people only in this neighborhood and that type of people only in this other neighborhood. That's the only way we get rid of this sad situation, and housing projects, poor people's neighborhood housing should be eliminated. If you want to help the poor, give them money and let them find their housing, subsidize them, whatever you want to do, but they should not be a poor people's neighborhood.
Okay, thank you, Alex, for that. So Alex is saying that concentrating low-income people in areas is not a good solution. And I think in most development circles, people are looking at mixed use and mixed income developments these days. Let's go to Nicole in San Francisco. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to your call.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to be a lot more simple. I'm a cab driver. I don't like to generalize, but I'm driving these young invaders around for 10 hours a day. And unfortunately, they don't care about San Francisco. Young invaders, these young 26-year-olds who make $120,000 a year who come here recently. They don't care about the city. I mean, it's not their city. They haven't been here for 50 years. I understand that. But all they care about is turning the city into a big beer garden, just trampling over everyone and everything. and they're not gracious. They treat us cab drivers like crap. I mean, they say, you know, all this new Uber, Lyft, and sidecar stuff. Cab drivers now are sleeping in their own cabs. They can't afford housing because we're not making any more money. And when I talk to these kids about that, they say that they don't want to wait 10 minutes for a cab. Yet they're waiting 2 hours for an ice cream cone in front of Byright Creamery. I mean, they're waiting 3 hours to get lunch. I don't get it.
So Nicole, I would love to keep you on the line longer, but you seem to have an invader on your phone line there. We're getting this beeping. Otherwise, I'd love to hear more about how you've seen the city change. Do you live in San Francisco?
I do, and I actually lost my lease because I was paying $1,500 a month for one bedroom, and now they're getting $4,000. So I'm actually living at a friend's house and looking to rent a place, and I'm a cab driver, disabled cab driver, and I'm going up against, you know, these professionals.
Right.
I'm probably going to have to move to Hayward. I mean, that's where we should probably all invest, because that's where we're going to end up.
I'm going to get Carl and Michael to respond to that. I mean, that's something that we're hearing commonly, that working class people can't afford to live in this city any longer, Carl.
Well, and it's also the anger that was just articulated. I think a lot of people feel that, and there is this perception of people coming in and this term invader. I think that, again, what we need to do is we need to think about fundamentally transforming how we produce housing and how we can increase affordability components. I will say, I just want to, you know, say on a personal note, one of my oldest and dearest friends is also a cab driver and has also complained to me about this sense of just a perception of a very different culture that's very arrogant, that people experience as very entitled. And I think this is what gives the emotional charge to what we call.
But haven't we always had that? I mean, this is a nation of immigrants. This is a city of people always coming in to reinvent themselves. We've always had waves of newcomers. Most of the time, people don't like the new people. That kind of gets to one of the issues that we raised at the beginning. Who has a right to be here?
Right.
Who's a local, right?
And I actually agree with all those things. I do not think the solution is to try and exclude people, is to see San Francisco as sort of this embattled place that we need to erect gates and keep invaders out. I don't think that's the solution. I think we need to find ways to be inclusive. I think we need to find ways to make this a city where artists, working families, people other than high-tech workers can come and live here. So my vision of the good city, of where we should be moving to, is to have a city, yes, that can attract people, that can bring people in, that could even densify, but to do it in a way where it's not excluding people who are driving a cab or trying to raise a family or want to play in a band.
So I'd like to ask both of you, how do we do that? And I have tons of callers on the lines that I want to get to, so I'm going to ask you to be brief as you solve the city's housing problem.
Well, if I can jump in, I want to say the most important distinction, I think it's important to draw distinctions, is that one, in my experience in San Francisco, there's some old diehards who insist that the enemy is market rate housing. And I could cite studies from Ed Glaser and Harvard, Joe Gierko and Penn, and I can go on and on and on. The people that deny that there's a housing market and that if we don't supply housing, that it's not going to affect price, are the equivalent to people denying climate science. We have to acknowledge that there's a ton of people who want to live here. So to me, the distinction is it's a yes and proposition. Yes to increasing the amount of market rate housing in the right places, near transit, not out in the middle of the Victorian neighborhoods, but downtown and south of Market and those areas where there's been planning for it. And yes to appropriately subsidized and located mixed-income housing. The problem is there's a very strong faction in the city that seems to think you need to say no to market rate housing to be able to say yes to moderate income and low income housing. And I would argue that that is a false dichotomy. And beyond that, it actually undermines the funding for that affordable housing, because market rate housing now by the law contributes on a per unit basis between $40,000 to $100,000 a door toward affordable housing in the form of inclusionary subsidies and other fees. And so there's a misperception that market rate housing is the cause of cost increases. it's part of the solution. It is not, as Carl rightly says, the only solution. Because for deep affordability, for very low-income and low-income housing, we also need government subsidies.
All right, that's Michael Yarny. He's a partner at Build, Inc., which is a San Francisco-based urban mixed-use residential developer. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're also joined by Carl Beitel, who is the author of the new book, Local Protest, Global Movements, Capital, Community, and State in San Francisco, which examines the history of gentrification and development in the city and asks what lessons we can learn from that. We have so many callers on the line, Carl. I'm going to just go through a couple of them and then go back to you. Let's go to Mark in Salinas. Welcome to your call. Can you please be brief just because we're running short on time?
Yes, I just wanted to interject that I need to live in the city due to health problems, and I can't get quality care here in the South Bay. And I want to be there, and I recently came out there to look at a condo, and I found out the building had been Ellis-act. It was a condo. It was an apartment building full of people with AIDS that were essentially kicked out. The building was Ellis-acted. It's now all luxury units. And all the neighbors, when I walked by, not all of them, but a couple of them did mention things, told me this history about this building in the 100 block of Dolores. And I just think it's sad that these poor folks went to who knows where and are probably not getting the care they got and the comfort they got in living in a secure building, and they're now where Ellis acted out.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. I'll get a comment in just a moment. Let's go to Peter in San Francisco. Welcome to your call. And again, Peter, I'm going to ask you to be brief just because we're running low on time.
Hi. This is Peter, and I'm with the with an organization called the Council of Community Housing Organization. I know both of your guests very well. And I want to ask a very straightforward kind of a data question, because I think the debates over supply and demand and its impacts can go on forever. And I've actually had long conversations with Michael about this. But here's a question. Just on the streets today, there's construction cranes everywhere. We hear that there are thousands and thousands of units under construction. What are they pricing for? You know, how, whether they're rental or ownership, I think the average person on the street just wants to know, would I be able to afford to live in that unit when it comes up on the market? And other than just real random kind of anecdotal evidence, I don't think any of us really know that answer. But I'm very curious for us to get a sense of what's all this new construction going to be priced for, and who is it actually serving? Because I think that's part of answering the question of your show. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Let's go to Henry in San Francisco, and then I'll have you guys respond to these three. Henry, welcome to your call.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Good morning, Michael. I haven't talked to you in a long time. So I was on the...
Hi, Henry.
How are you? So I was on the South of Market Project Area Committee for over 10 years, to the advisory body to the Redevelopment Agency. And I would say one thing that's for sure, we were really aghast about, and I thought it was really criminal what happened in Western Addition. That was a true disaster what they did to that area.
You're talking the urban renewal. So I'm going to ask you to be brief, Henry, because we really are running low.
No, I understand. But I will say, on the other hand, since then, they did work with the people in the neighborhood. Largely affordable housing. Look at Mercy Housing that was built on the corner of Mission and 10th Street. You look at one on the corner of 6th and Howard that the redevelopment did, that affordable housing. There was a building, the wonderful defenestration on it, that... we voted to take it by eminent domain because the owner just wouldn't do nothing to it. And that was going to become also affordable housing. So in the long run, I think redevelopment at the end really woke up that we're doing the right thing.
So
sad to see them go, but I'm glad there was a successor agency that came in.
All right. Thank you for that. So, guys, I want to get you to respond to Mark, who talked about the Ellis Act and the fact that it is often targeting very vulnerable populations that are displaced. And in Carl's book, he talks about the experience of the iHotel and how that really affected the city in terms of vulnerable populations being evicted. And then Peter had a very specific question, which is, what does it cost to live in these new units, and who are they really being built for? Why don't we start with you, Michael, and then we'll go and let Carl have the last word here.
Yeah, great. Ellis Act, it is really tragic what that gentleman was describing, but my response is both place some compassion for those people. But more importantly, it's a symptom of not having adequate supply. What's happening is that less, I would say, less scrupulous people, I mean, more inscrupulous people are taking advantage of that, and because there's such high demand for housing, and that's why we're seeing those sorts of things. And to me, the answer is, I mean, is the Rincon Hill high-rise is part of the answer. We need more market rate supply so that the pressure, the demand pressure on San Francisco's neighborhood is lessened.
And what does it cost to live in one of those units?
You know, I would suggest, and Peter is very adept, I would suggest going to the marketing websites because I'm not an expert, but they're expensive units. But here's the good news. Those units are serving a market segment that otherwise would be pushing into the neighborhoods and rising prices further. But also, every one of those projects is contributing millions and millions of dollars towards affordable housing.
And let me go now, Michael, just because we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure Carl also gets to respond to this. And another listener asked, well, where are people evicted going? Are they ending up displacing people in other neighborhoods? So, Carl, if you could just respond to the callers and kind of do a wrap-up here.
Sure. The Ellis Act, the Ellis Act is a huge problem. We need to look at ways at a local level to see if we can strengthen the protections or the costs for people being Ellis Acted, impose higher costs on developers. I do not agree that Ellis Act evictions would stop if you build more market rate housing, although we could debate that later. And in terms of answering Peter's question, I don't know the exact cost of these units either, but there is a way to get a proxy of this. And the fact is that the affordable housing requirement currently is, I think, 15%. So what is actually happening in San Francisco is that 85% of housing is being built at a rate that at least half the population cannot afford. And if you actually look at the data I've looked at, it's actually building housing for most of this housing is being built probably for the top 10%. And I just want to, you know, tag once again that there's a huge, the elephant in the room in part is the expectation private developers have that they can generate 30% rates of return on development in San Francisco. There's, I think, a huge culture of entitlement. And San Francisco is seen as this pot of gold that people can extract these enormous rents from. And I think we need to put that on the table as part of any discussion about how we reframe thinking about development in a market like San Francisco.
Well, we're out of time for this particular show. I apologize to all of the callers that we couldn't get to. Clearly, there is a lot of discussion that needs to happen around this. And I want to thank both of you for allowing there to be such a civil debate on such a contentious issue. We've been speaking with Carl Beitel, who's the author of the new book, Local Protest, Global Movements, Capital Community, and State in San Francisco. He'll be reading and discussing the book tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Green Arcade, which is on Market Street. It's free and wheelchair accessible. We've also been joined by Michael Yarny, who's a partner at Build Inc., which is a mixed-use developer. Thanks to both of you. We'll put links to all of that information and more resources at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. You can also continue the conversation there by using the comment button and sharing any stories, resources that you have. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Thanks to all of the callers, and I apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What can we learn from past struggles? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with John Trudell, an acclaimed poet and activist. His involvement in the 21-month-long occupation of Alcatraz Island in the late 1960s brought international attention to the American Indian cause. So what are the keys to a successful protest movement? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.